start off by asking you guys tonight, how do we approach the problems that we face as people who are trying to follow God? Okay, let me say that again. How do we approach problems that we face as people who are seeking to follow God? This is a very open-ended and random question, but in asking it, I have a very pointed point that I want to make. A couple years ago, I heard a story, and I can't remember if it's a real story or if it's a joke, but as I was thinking about this message, I thought, you know, I'll try to appropriate this thing, so I may tell this, and this may end up going off, like, terribly, and so please forgive me if it does. I don't remember the whole deal, and I couldn't remember where I found it, so I'm just going to do my best telling it, and hopefully it'll illustrate the point, and then we'll go from there, okay? So you guys aren't going to hold me to too high a standard on this one. The story is about some guy who gets himself into a mess, falls off a cliff or does something and is hanging off a cliff, you know, hanging onto a root, and as the root is bearing the weight of his body and it begins to go, he begins to pray, "Lord God, please rescue me. Help me, help me." About that time, a hiker passes by and says to him, "Looks like you're in trouble. Would you like some help?" To which he replied, "No, I'm praying and waiting for God to rescue me." More time passes, root begins to go down. Pretty soon, you know, he begins to pray some more, "God, God, please help me." Park ranger passes underneath, says, "Yo, you look like you're having some trouble up there. Would you like some help?" To which he replies, no, I'm praying, I'm waiting for God to rescue me." I don't remember what the third person that walks by is. I guess some guy on a burro rides by or something like that and says, "Would you like to help me?" And of course we know his answer. No, I'm waiting for God to help me. At that point, the branch breaks. He falls and plummets to his death, at which point he goes to heaven and says, God, I trusted you. Why didn't you help me?" And obviously the answer is, you know, "I tried to help you three different times, but you were too much of a dummy to figure it out." You know, I think a lot of times in our spiritual life, sometimes we approach problems that way as people who follow God. We so badly want there to be an extraordinarily spiritual answer to the problems that we face that we sometimes miss the opportunities for getting them worked out that are right before our eyes. In fact, I think that oftentimes we approach problems as people who are Christians in a very simple way. One, we simply pray and say, "God, please answer this problem X." And then as a follow-up to then, we patiently wait. And we say, "God, we're waiting for you to answer the issue." Now, you have to understand, this is a biblical approach to trying to have some of our problems and challenges answered. You know, it is right in line with what Scripture says. Pray and ask God for what you need. At the same time, wait on God to provide an answer. And yet, in the same way, you guys, I think that that's a little bit too narrow approach for how we have to understand God working in the world, as if the only thing that is required of us is simple trust and fervent prayer. I mean, those are very important things as we wait for God to intervene on our behalf. And I sometimes think that we believe to act beyond that praying and waiting is to show a lack of faith, to wait for God to do something. And yet, like I said, even while that is true and somewhat biblical, it's too narrow because it misses the larger scope of the way I think God works in the world. Chris, I'm still getting a little bit of a ring back here. I'm not sure why it's so ringy. One thing I would like to challenge us on in this approach to addressing problems and our challenges in our life is that it has a basic and tacit underlying assumption that God's activity in our world is passive and not active. In other words, God just sits back and waits for us to approach Him with problems that we have, and then we try to cajole Him into responding to what we think we need. It doesn't take into consideration the simple fact that God is constantly and actively at work in the world. And going before us and going after us, we didn't ask God to save us. The incarnation and the presence of Jesus Christ in the world was His initiative, His action in our world. And so I think that we often approach God in a theologically naive way to assume that God just sits around and waits for us to present Him with our problems as if He isn't completely and already aware of and active in our lives. You know what I'm saying when I mean that? And the second is this, that somehow we have a part to play in the answering of our prayers. See, I think this is significant. I think it's a great place to start if you have no understanding or no relationship to God to begin to say, and you're used to totally taking care of matters your own way and seizing things in your own hands and making life work on your terms, then to begin to slow down and to pray and to submit your life to God and ask Him, God, what is it you want for me? Rather than me going out and seizing it, that's a good first place to start and to wait for God to provide, especially through His body, the church. But I think there are other people that have been so long in the game, in the following of Christ, that our faith has become more passive. And so the question is, what does it look like to approach problems as people who follow God? See, I believe that faith, people who are faithfully seeking God and seeking to live out their lives as disciples of Jesus Christ, as He moves along the path through life in front of us, faith is best expressed by seeking out opportunity that God has already initiated on our behalf. Not assuming that God is not working, but always assuming that God is working and that our eyes are peeled, constantly scanning the horizon of opportunities, relationships, situations, looking for evidence of God's movement in our life and joining Him in it and rushing in and risking. See, this guy hanging off the cliff, he thought that if God were to respond to him, God would respond in such an unimaginable way that there would be no question as to who saved him. And yet it has never been the case in my life that God does something so convincingly that it's not possible to interpret it in another way. You see what I'm saying? You talk to two people who go through the same experience, and some people will attribute the rescue to the people who were there. Other people will associate it to saying, no, God provided. See, God leaves room in the mix there for us to choose to respond to Him by faith. And so, it is my belief that faith, people who are approaching problems in life and challenges as people who follow God, seek out opportunities and willingly engage in risk as a demonstration and a reality of the way that they're living out their life. And so my question to you tonight, both as perhaps there are people here who are followers of Christ and those who are not, what is your risk factor? Particularly as it relates to your relationship to God. As you move through life and you're presented with issues and problems and opportunities, do you sit back and you simply wait for God to reveal the writing on the wall? Are you constantly scanning the horizon in fellowship with His people, listening to His Spirit, looking for opportunities that might be a good decision and might not, that involve you to risk and step out and really depend on Christ in a way that really matters, that it would actually be faith? Anybody ever done any rock climbing? You don't think sitting back in a harness requires some faith? There is actually a possible consequence that if the person at the bottom of the belay does not have that thing cinched off, you're going to go down. I've done that. It's not fun. And yet somehow I think that we think God is a cosmic insurance policy that should keep us from having to risk and having to really hang it out there. Right? I don't read that when I read my Bible. And so here we are in the third chapter of Ruth. And every week that we do this, it gets harder and harder to recap what's gone before, because the story continues to play out. But I'm going to do a quick recap of the story of Ruth. We find it in the first half of the Old Testament. And Ruth is a story about a woman named Naomi, even though it's named Ruth, who lives in a period in Israel's history where there are no kings and the patriarchs are all dead, and so they're living in a time when the land is ruled by judges, and it's a pretty chaotic and anarchical time. And the story of Ruth picks up after a famine has occurred in Israel, and a specific family, this family of Elimelech, whose name means God is king, his wife Naomi and their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, whose names mean sickness and annihilation, foreshadowing, have to leave Israel, specifically Bethlehem, which we know means house of what? Bread. Leaves Bethlehem to go to Moab, a neighboring country that does not worship God, for the purpose of securing food. While they are there, the two sons marry two women, Orpah and Ruth, who are Moabite women. Okay, first Elimelech dies, and then shortly after that, Mahlon and Chilion die, and their names become prophetic. Sickness Obviously, it's resulted in death and annihilation. See, because the Israelites measured their family wealth not in terms of money, although that was important, but in terms of offspring and land. And so Naomi, this elderly Jewish woman, now finds herself living in a foreign land with two foreign-born daughters-in-law and no men in her family. And so after a time, she comes to herself and says, you know what, this is stupid. I'm not staying here. The famine's over in Israel. I'm going back to my home. And her two daughters-in-law set out on the road with her. And once they're on the road, they say, you know what, Naomi says to them, this is stupid. Why are you coming with me? This is your home. I'm not going to have any more kids for you to marry. This is stupid. Orpah agrees and says, you know what, it's been nice knowing you. I'm heading back. And it's a very reasonable decision. But Ruth has a very different reaction. She says, may God deal with me ever so severely if I in any way separate my life from you. Then the famous passage that we've quoted, where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people, my people. Your God, my God. And in that instance, she demonstrates a characteristic of God that we've called what? The Hebrew word? That's good. Chesed. We do that H that describes God's compassionate grace and faithfulness and loyalty to his people. In other words, Ruth, the daughter-in-law, goes above and beyond and pledges herself to her mother-in-law and says, don't let me be separated from you. My life is now intertwined with you. And she shows to her mother-in-law the kind of love and devotion, chesed, that God shows to his people. And so we believe that God's attention is focused. They go back to Bethlehem. The women around the town say, look who God has brought back. Naomi, she says, don't call me Naomi, which means pleasant. Call me Mara, for my existence has become bitter to me. They arrive at the beginning of the barley harvest. It's the end of April. Now, the second chapter we begin to pick up, we understand that now there are 2 months of harvest, and Ruth and Naomi are in serious danger because they're two women without men who have no way of securing food. And they're at the beginning of the barley harvest, which lasts 2 months. Actually, the barley, then the wheat harvest, goes for 2 months, and that has to provide food for the entire year. So unless they get something figured out, they're going to starve. And so Ruth has this idea. She says, you know what? I'm going to go out and glean in the fields, recognizing that God had set up in his word laws that were to provide for people who could not provide for themselves, the poor and the aliens. And so Ruth's plan was to follow behind the people that were harvesting the field and pick up the remaining sheaves of wheat and glean and just try and get enough to barely make it by. A commentator commented that basically this is not a great way to make a living. It's the equivalent of trying to live on collecting aluminum cans and turning it in for change. That would have been the kind of subsistence living that Naomi and Ruth would have had. And it would have been very short-lived, not for a whole year, but just for the months that the gleaning would have gone on. But it turns out that Ruth shows up in Boaz's field. And Boaz is a relative, although they don't know him yet, really. And Boaz seeks her out and says, who is this young woman? It turns out Ruth has a reputation. The people know who she is, and that he gives her a blessing. He gives her permission to glean. He provides protection for her, because a woman who is poor and an alien living in the midst of the culture would have been very vulnerable. And so he provides perfection. Beyond that, he provides provision for her. He says, not only may you glean, he tells his workers to leave out provision for her so that she doesn't have to quite work as hard. And so at the end of one day, she's got the equivalent of half a month's worth of wages. And by the end of the whole season, she and Naomi now have food for the season. And so the first issue that comes up in the book of Ruth, that issue of food and starvation, has been resolved. And God has begun to reawaken. See, some of the themes that are present in this book that we've talked about are these. One, that ordinary people are the people who inhabit this story. There are people like you and me whose life circumstances conspire in such a way to leave them in a place of extraordinary vulnerability. And we've all been that place. And yet, ordinary people are capable of extraordinary behavior, which we begin to see in this story. First, Ruth and her amazing chesed pledge to her mother-in-law. Boaz's treatment of Ruth, this vulnerable person who is ripe for exploitation. Third theme, incognito God. Sometimes when life is not working, God seems curiously absent. And that is certainly the case in this passage. In fact, Naomi attributes all of her pain and all of her misfortune right to God, lays it straight at his feet, and doesn't apologize one iota for saying, God, you have done this to me. Pretty powerful. The implication, are you going to make it right? And the last theme, that ordinary people expressing extraordinary behavior, even when God seems to be missing, are able to achieve extraordinary things because of who God is. So, let's jump into the passage for tonight. Will you turn with me to Ruth? We're in chapter 3. If you grabbed a Bible when you came in, that's found on page 219. We're going to read through this. In the last couple weeks, I pseudo had my act together and tried to do a little bit more of a dramatic reading thing where I would have a woman be Ruth and a different woman be Naomi and a guy be Boaz, but I didn't get my act together and have that. So rather than putting anybody on the spot tonight and sticking a microphone in your face and doing that, I just think I'll just be the narrator and all the characters, but I'm not going to change my voice, okay? So, okay, the first four verses are where we're going to jump in. And in these four verses, we begin to discover that Naomi is beginning to recover. She actually is beginning to develop some initiative, and she's got a plan that she's going to hatch. Page 219, Ruth chapter 3, verses 1 through 4. One day, Naomi said to Ruth, "My daughter, it's time that I found a permanent home for you so that you will be provided for. Boaz is a close relative of ours, and he's been very kind by letting you gather grain with his workers. Tonight he will be winnowing barley at the threshing floor. Now, do as I tell you. Take a bath and..." Good first step. "Take a bath and put on perfume and dress in your nicest clothes. Then go to the threshing floor, but don't let Boaz see you until he has finished his meal. Be sure to notice where he lies down. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down there. He will tell you what it is you are to do." Okay, very kind of little mysterious passage here. It says at the end of chapter 2 that all the while Ruth was living with her mother-in-law. Okay, this is fine. She's being provided for, but it doesn't address the second problem of this book. The first being food and famine, the second being fertility and a lack of children. Ruth is not going to have a very good opportunity to get pregnant and get married, well, hopefully in the reverse order, get married and get pregnant and have offspring and continue Naomi's line if she's living with her mother-in-law. Right? And so Naomi begins to look more long-term at the issue of what's going on here, and she says, "Here's the deal. I have got to think provisionally for your future and for mine." In fact, it's a very interesting word choice here in the Hebrew. It says this. It says, "My daughter, it's time that I find a permanent home for you." Home manuha, which means resting place. And this is interesting. And this, what she's saying is, a home is, the nature of the Hebrew word there is a resting place, meaning rest that is secured by marriage. So Naomi's not messing around. We lose the nuance of this in the English translation, but in the Hebrew, what she was saying is, it's time for me to find a place for you to settle in for the long term, for you to be married, for you to be settled in, for you to have the kind of security that can only be provided by a stabilized home where you are in relationship with a man who is looking out for you. And so she's really seeking out over Ruth's future provision. And it's amazing to me the difference in the transformation that we're beginning to see in Naomi in this passage. In the first passage, she's saying, "My existence is bitter to me. God has dealt severely with me. I left full, I come back empty. The Lord has made it thus. My life is extraordinarily bitter. The Lord has caused me to suffer, and the Almighty has sent tragedy." I'm sure many of us here have felt that way before. In the second chapter, we begin to see something different. At Ruth's initiative, they begin to find provision and they begin to see God at work. And so Boaz says to Ruth in chapter 2, verse 12, "May the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge, reward you fully." And Naomi responds at the extraordinary outpouring of grace and compassion and provision, "May the Lord bless the one who helped you." She's beginning to respond to the fact that her circumstances are looking up, even though they're unclear. And she says, the man I worked with is Boaz. And she says, may the Lord bless him. And now in the third chapter, we see her coming even further out of her grief and out of her isolation and out of her despair and her depression. Actually beginning to think beyond herself and into the care of somebody else, even though it will also serve her. Because I believe that she sees provision and a potential ally in Boaz, an opportunity that she wants to seize. Her faith is active and not passive, simply sitting back waiting for God to do something. See, I think in the context of this story, I am challenged by the fact that hope is the function of a future that we can believe in. Where there is no future, where we have no possibility for growth and security, we lose hope and fall prey to despair. There are people here tonight that as you look at your future, you are convinced that there is not much ahead of you that you have to look forward to, and chances are that your heart is filled with pain and despair and brokenness. Because you can't believe that out there is something that might be different from the circumstances you now possess. I think you are in league with many other people here who have lived or are currently living in the same place, including Naomi. And yet I think Naomi's transformation here before our very eyes is extraordinarily instructive, because she begins to recognize that her future has possibility and that hope is a function of that. And so she says, I want to find for you provision. And then she says this, Boaz is a close relative of us, and he's been very kind by letting you gather grain with his workers. See, Boaz's family status was that he was called a kinsman redeemer. The nuances of this are lost on us today because we're not an agricultural-based family system or even economy. And so we don't know the intricacies of this. But basically, this was a provision set up in the Mosaic Law, in the Torah, to provide for people who could not provide for themselves. As the family unit was the most important unit in the culture, what would happen when the family struggled or suffered? Well, God set it up with his people that there were these people called Goel, kinsmen redeemers. They're a circle of close relatives whose duty it was to look out for weaker clan members. And Naomi says, Boaz, this guy that you just happened to find yourself in his field, he's one of our kinsmen redeemers. He's a Goel. And it comes from Leviticus chapter 25. Verses 24 through 27. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff in Leviticus 25 about it. Let me just read you a little bit. This is from Leviticus 25. With every sale of land, there must be a stipulation that the land can be redeemed at any time. See, the land belonged to the people. To have land was to be God's people in this setting. And any time you had to sell your land, there was always a stipulation that once you sold it, you could get it back. If any of your Israelite relatives go bankrupt and are forced to sell some inherited land, then a close relative, a kinsman redeemer, may buy it back for them. If there is no one to redeem the land, but the person who sold it manages to get enough money to buy it back, then that person has the right to redeem it from the one who bought it. The price of the land will... Anyway, it's a provision to keep people from being exploited. And so the responsibilities of a kinsman redeemer were to buy back the land of poor relatives who had to mortgage it in order to get food, to buy the freedom of poor relatives who sold themselves into slavery to get out of debt, to help poor relatives get justice in court, to keep family and land together. And then here's the one that's most significant, to marry the widow of a dead relative whose husband died without children. Annihilation of the family line. And so a kinsman redeemer was somebody who could marry the widow of a man who died without producing offspring or whose offspring had died. It keeps the family from going out. And so what Naomi's basically doing in this passage, in these first four verses, is telling Ruth, hey, you know what? You need provision. Boaz is a guy who can provide it. I want you to go and propose marriage to him. How about that, ladies? Huh? I like it. You know, now, you may have missed out the nuances of it here, but what she says is, be sure to notice where he lies down, then go and uncover his feet and lie down there. He will tell you what to do. Okay, this is a pretty significant tradition that we might miss out on, so I want to read something from a commentary that talks about this phenomenon. It says, what does the uncover his feet gesture mean? Probably it was a symbolic proposal of marriage. That explanation fits well with Ruth's actual request for marriage in verse 9. In Israel, the word feet was a euphemism for human sexual organs. Okay? And they give a bunch of examples of it here. It says, perhaps by uncovering his feet, Ruth showed her readiness for marriage and for sexual relations with this man. So what Naomi's telling her to do is to say, hey, go tell this guy that you are available to be married to him. And see what happens. Now, she does tell him. Now, remember, Ruth, what has she been doing for the last 2 months? Working all day in the field. So she says, listen, don't go goating out like you are right now. You need to go, you need to bathe, you need to make yourself attractive. I mean, let's not be stupid here. And let's wait till Boaz has eaten and drinking a little bit. He'll be a little bit more susceptible to being persuaded. The text is very clear. And so Ruth says to him, I will do everything you've commanded. Let's keep going. Verses 5 through 9. I will do everything you say, Ruth replied. So she went down to the threshing floor that night and followed the instructions of her mother-in-law. After Boaz had finished his meal and was in good spirits, he lay down beside the heap of grain and went to sleep. Then Ruth came quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. Around midnight, Boaz suddenly woke up and turned over. He was surprised to find a woman lying at his feet. Who are you? He demanded. I am your servant, Ruth, she replied. Spread the corner of your covering over me, for you are my family redeemer. So Ruth obediently takes on the challenge that Naomi gives to her. And I think one of the things that we miss out on listening to this story today is the extraordinary level of risk that Ruth took on in doing this. It was extraordinarily dangerous for her to do this. And I'm just curious, just reading the story, what might you guess might be some of the reasons that this would be risky for Ruth to do this? Anyone? Rejection. Absolutely. Jim, is it you? Did you say that? Kurt, more thoughts on that? Yeah, just in other words, she's going and she's making herself totally vulnerable to this guy and saying, hey, here I am. And we forget the fact that she is a Moabitess. She's an outsider living in a community of insiders who's really taking some bold initiative, and she's been so far favored. She's so far been favored by Boaz. But you know what? I mean, he could have gone any number of ways on this deal. And so she risked not only just rejection on a personal, relational level, because it definitely seems like there's some kind of spark there in their interactions, but on another hand, she has secured somewhat of a status for her, and by exposing herself in this way, she could even lose the little that she's gained. And so that's definitely true. Any other thoughts on the things that she risked there? Anyone? Now, I think she risked physical danger, going out by herself late at night, in kind of secretive way. But here's another thing. I think her reputation was extraordinarily at risk. As I was doing this, one of the things I learned was that the threshing floor was the first century ancient equivalent of a brothel. In other words, the workers would work all day, they'd drink, they'd get hammered, and then the prostitutes would come onto the... And that would be a place where that would happen. And so Ruth is now vulnerable of being perceived as making advances in that way. And not only just ruining her own reputation, but ruining the reputation of Boaz, a man who is an incredible civic leader. The text says he's a man of standing. And so this is an extraordinarily risky deal. Boaz says he's startled. Ah! Wakes up in the middle of the night. Seems like she'd been there for a little while, and who knows what he thought was happening, but he goes to roll over, and all of a sudden he can't move. I mean, it says he tried to turn over, then he realized there was somebody laying on his feet. I mean, can you imagine? So who knows what he thinks going on here? And it could be that he thought he was being propositioned not in the way that Ruth was, but by a prostitute. And so chances are he was quite startled. And so he says, who are you? He demanded. Ruth says, I am Ruth. marry me. I am Ruth. I am your servant Ruth. Spread the corner of your covering over me, for you are my family redeemer. See, there's a number of things here that are quite extraordinary. In that marriage proposal, Boaz would have heard that you are my kinsman and redeemer. I am looking to you to produce a child. Secondarily, and you may not have picked up on this, okay, Boaz is a substitute. Ruth is a substitute. Who is it that really needs the kinsman redeemer? Naomi. But Naomi is not of childbearing years anymore. And so Ruth is saying, I am here on my mother-in-law's half, proposing marriage to you so that my mother-in-law can have her line going. In other words, she's saying, I'm marrying you out of duty. There are a lot of reasons people get married today, and they're almost romantic. And yet Ruth says, my life is less important than the pledge of a loyalty and compassion and grace that I have made. And so once again, we see her amazing character here. In fact, it's kind of interesting, because the same word that's used to describe the word garment edge is the same word that's translated back in chapter 2 in verse 12 when he says, may God, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have taken refuge, protect you. In other words, wing, garment edge. So what she's basically saying is, hey, you prayed that God would cover me with his wings. I'm coming under your wings. Will you stand up to what you prayed? Will you be the answer to the prayer that you prayed? Wow. Will you fulfill what you asked God to do on my behalf? It's pretty amazing. What's Boaz's reaction? Let's keep reading. Verses 10 through 15. The Lord bless you, my daughter, Boaz exclaimed. You are showing more family loyalty now than ever by not running after a younger man, whether rich or poor. So he's saying, listen, I'm assuming you could go after anybody. You could have gone after a younger guy. This is not about you. You're laying your life down. Now, don't worry about a thing, my daughter. I will do what is necessary. And this is great, for everyone in town knows that you are an honorable woman. But there is one problem. While it is true that I am one of your family redeemers, there is another. Sounds like Star Wars, doesn't it? There is another. There is another man who is more closely related to you than I am. Stay here tonight, and in the morning I will talk to him. If he is willing to redeem you, then let him marry you. But if he is not willing, then as surely as the Lord lives, I will marry you. Now lay here until morning. So Ruth laid at Boaz's feet until the morning, but she got up before it was light enough for people to recognize each other. For Boaz had said, no one must know that a woman was here at the threshing floor. Nothing was done inappropriately here, but he's very concerned for the reputation of himself, of his business, and of Ruth. And so he says, stay here. I want you to be protected. This is not a safe time for you to be out. At the same time, you must leave before anybody wakes up. Boaz also said to her, bring your cloak and spread it out. He measured out six scoops of barley into the cloak and helped her put it on her back. Then Boaz returned to the town. Okay, man, this is great. So basically what Boaz does is he says, you know what? Everything you've asked, it will happen. Blessings to you on Naomi's behalf. He assures her that he will provide for her. But then there's a wrinkle in the story. Did y'all pick it up? We've seen this mounting tension between Ruth and Boaz. And we think this story's just plugging along real quick, and then there's this... He says, however, there is another kinsman redeemer who has first rights at this, an opportunity to do this. And so when we initially start celebrating the fact that he said yes, we misinterpret what it is he's saying yes to. He is saying, I will be responsible for negotiating your provision. Not that I will be the one who gets to enjoy the results of it. And so he says, listen, this is a problem, but I've got a plan. And so he goes in and he says, I will take care of this. In fact, it will be resolved soon. And then he says this, come here. And he takes her and he gets her to spread out her cloak and he pours more provision on her. Now, we have to read the last passage to figure out what the significance of this might be, but one of the reasons why this might be important was because here's Ruth. What's she doing out in the middle of the morning wandering around? Oh, she comes back with food. She's been working all night. Who knows? Maybe that's what he was thinking, or maybe this. Okay, last three verses. Ruth's report to Naomi. When Ruth went back to her mother-in-law, Naomi asked, what happened, my daughter? I mean, you have to realize that Naomi had to be freaking out the entire night, sending her daughter-in-law on this risky venture, hoping somehow that God would protect her. Ruth told Naomi everything Boaz had done for her. And she added, he gave me these 6 scoops of barley and said, don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. Then Naomi said to her, just be patient, my daughter, until we hear what happens. The man won't rest until he has followed through on this. He will settle it today. Now, a couple interesting things as we wind down tonight. What is the very thing that Naomi said against God at the beginning of this story, Ruth? I went away full, but the Lord returned me home empty. Boaz's statement to Ruth, take these scoops of barley and said, don't go back to your mother-in-law empty. In other words, foreshadowing that God is providing for Naomi's needs. And so she says, this is going to work out. However it works out, Boaz will make this done. More success, more provision, reputation intact, and it ends by Naomi counseling patience. But yet, this will be resolved just hours from now, or 1 week from now, actually. And so I want to challenge you tonight as we started out by talking about how do you approach problems and challenges that you face in your life? Do you sit back passively and wait for God to orchestrate some extraordinary thing, or do you believe actively that God is moving around you and orchestrating at all times events, and that he is desperately looking for people who are waiting for him to respond? Is your view of God one of passivity or activity? And how risk averse is your faith? Would you have been like Naomi, willing to hatch a plan to secure your future and the future of your daughter-in-law? Would you have been like Ruth, who would be willing to go out in the middle of the night and risk rejection and reputation and physical danger for the sake of somebody you love, not even your own sake? And would you be like Boaz, willing to go out on a limb for somebody who asked you for protection? How do you view yourself in the mix? Let's pray. Jesus, thank you for this opportunity to gather tonight in your presence, in the midst of your church, and with the opportunity to open your word. Lord, I confess that oftentimes my faith is more passive, my view of you is more passive. Lord, my faith is small. And so I pray tonight as we read this, the story of these people, of Ruth and Naomi and Boaz, their amazing character, their willingness to trust, even when you seem to be absent. Lord, help us to have faith like theirs. And Lord, help us to apply it into our life now, not to simply hear an interesting story where we learn some neat Hebrew words, but oh Lord, actually write this on our hearts. Show us how we might follow you, Lord, now and today. It's in your name we pray, Jesus. Amen.